Okay, good afternoon, everyone. A very warm welcome to you. Thank you for joining with us on a rather cold Tuesday afternoon to look at a rather future-orientated issue. Well done, firstly, for getting here. I know we're deep in the bowels of UCL, and I'm told there's some traffic delays as well, so people will probably join with us as there are many of the guests this afternoon, so we hope to have them join with us very shortly. But it is a great delight to have you with us this afternoon. My name is Matt James. I'm the director of BioCentre, and it's a great delight to have you join with us for this discussion. Are robots really after our jobs? If you are able to pick up a Wi-Fi signal and you tweet, we are using the hashtag this afternoon, BioCentre, as we do for many of our events. So please do contribute to the online conversation, which will hopefully result as the afternoon progresses. A brief word about BioCentre. We're a think tank based in Westminster, looking at the ethical, social and political implications presented by new and emerging technologies. However, unlike most think tanks, we're concerned as much about the conversation and how the questions are framed as we are about also trying to find out the answers. So in trying to host the conversation, our aim is to try and bring together all articulate perspectives around the table so we can have a meaningful conversation and learn from one another. And as part of this, multidisciplinary discussion is key. And this is particularly reflected in this afternoon's discussion. We're delighted to be partnering with UCL Science, Medicine and Society Network. This is a network based here at UCL designed to facilitate interdisciplinary analysis and action-oriented responses to new challenges to health and well-being. And BioCentre has been pleased to collaborate with the network on a number of occasions, including a discussion with Professor Kevin Warwick over the British Museum. Kevin, if you're not already familiar with him, claims to be the world's first cyborg. So it was a very interesting evening's discussion over at the British Museum, and we've partnered with the SMS network on other events since then. As with all our public events, this afternoon will be recorded, and we will be uploading the audio files online shortly after the events. By the end of the week, hopefully they'll be available at our website, www.bioethics.ac.uk. In terms of the format this afternoon, I'm going to give each of our speakers about 10 minutes each just to open up with some reflections and comments on this particular theme. I will then give the opportunity for the three of them to have a little bit of interchange, come back at one another, perhaps agree, disagree with some of the points that's been made, before opening up the floor for a rounded Q&A discussion with your good selves as well. This being a seat of learning and education, I'm told there is another lecture going to be taking place at 6 o'clock, so we will have to be fairly prompt with finishing at 6, but I'm sure we'll be in for a good discussion nonetheless. So, to this afternoon's discussion and theme. The idea of robots and intelligent machines running amok, taking over the world, has tended to be the mainstay of science fiction plots. Yet recent advances in AI mean that certain visions of the future could very quickly become more science reality. There's been significant progress made in our understanding of AI and deep neural networks, advances in computer power, speech recognition. I could go on. Things are advancing, is the least that we can say. Within the last decade, AI-driven products are beginning to become more prominent. And an particularly interesting thread in the conversation, which is centred around robots, is that of the future of work and the robots in the workplace. A report by Pew Research recently explored the views of some 2,000 experts on AI, artificial intelligence, robotics, economics, concerning the role of automation between now and 2025. And there was an almost perfect split between those that were very optimistic about the future, in contrast to those who expressed concern and extreme worry about the future. Some argue robots will create jobs and then they will take them over, whilst others worry that their arrival in the workplace will lead to a breakdown in society. To give just one example, and I'm sure there'll be many or others given this afternoon, as Google works on self-driving cars and those continue to develop, it's perhaps not difficult to see that the next big thing could be automated driving, threatening the many jobs of taxi drivers, lorry drivers, and others employed in transportation. Last year, Professor Stephen Hawking said the development of full artificial intelligence could in fact spell the end of the human race. Likewise, Elon Musk, the entrepreneur behind SpaceX, warned of the risk of something seriously dangerous happening as a result of machines with artificial intelligence could be in as few as 5 years. So whilst there's much to be debated and argued over, there is at least one clear area of consensus. Over the next decade, robots and AI will continue to increase and advance, leading to at least some degree of displacement of work by robots. And that, I think, alone warrants some serious engagement with what the future might hold. Which leads us to this afternoon's discussion, which we hope will not be perhaps a defining conversation, I don't think it will be, but we will at least help contribute to the ongoing conversation and need for engagement on this important topic. And we have a great lineup of speakers. Firstly, we have Dr. Anders Sandberg, the James Martin Research Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. We have Richard Excel, the Senior Policy Officer from the Trade Union Congress, TUC, and Professor Nigel Cameron, the President of the Centre for Policy on Emerging Technologies in Washington, but also Executive Chairman of Biocentre UK here in the UK. I will leave each of them to give a little bit of an explanation, one or two lines, biographical details, before they launch into their 10 minutes. Because I really want to offer them the floor to expand upon their ideas and then engage in the all-important discussion and debate that will follow. So we're delighted to have you with us as well, and hopefully this afternoon will be a very fruitful and engaging discussion on what seems to be a very fascinating debate. So would you please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Dr. Anders Sandberg.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. So, I'm a lapsed computational neuroscientist. I didn't decide what I wanted to work on, so I tried to study anything. And then, as a computer scientist, I found that, neural network, brains, borrowing good solutions from a system we actually know is pretty good at thinking. That seemed to be interesting. So I did my PhD about modeling how memory works in humans. And generally, of course, we have been able to make some rather good artificial intelligence by borrowing good ideas from biology. And this has been picking up speed recently. So that has been very successful, except, of course, that the whole field of artificial intelligence have had, from time to time, a quite well-deserved dodgy reputation. Back in the 50s, when it was founded, people were very optimistic. Oh yes, within a generation we will have human level thinking. The Dartmouth conference that kind of coined the term artificial intelligence suggested that we might actually be able to solve many of the fundamental problems by doing a summer school. And over time people continue being optimistic. Yeah, we're going to get the automatic translation and we're going to do this and that. The problem was, of course, many of these early promises didn't come through, and there was several times cases where government reports pointed out that, we're wasting a lot of money here. So then you got periods where nobody wanted to fund this thing, and then the field reappeared in new forms. And over time, it started to produce useful results, except, of course, that we don't recognize them as artificial intelligence. We tend to talk about them as automation. So when we use a search engine, or when we use the speech recognition, the Siri, we don't think of that as very much artificial intelligence. A lot of the systems in our computers are actually based on ideas from artificial intelligence, but as soon as they actually work well enough, we don't regard them as proper AI. So the result has been that we're actually rather bad at predicting the future of the artificial intelligence. And many of the revolutions seem to creep up on us. So automated cars are a very good example. Back in the early 2000s, experts were fairly confident that, making a car that can actually drive itself is going to be exceedingly hard because you need to have vision. You need to understand other parts of traffic. Yeah, that's really tough. And then the DARPA did this big competition to try out autonomous cars. And the first time, it was a fiasco. None of them reached the target. None of them even got very far. Some of them just tipped over. Everybody were laughing. The next year, they actually got to the goal. And the year after that, they got to the gold fast. And I think it, the fourth competition, they had driving in traffic. The interesting thing here is that you have a very rapid progress based on a few technologies that were taken up. You had better computing power, but also big data that allowed you to do machine learning on a large scale. And together, they moved the autonomous cars from something even the experts didn't believe could actually work to something that might be serious business one day. Certainly the car industry is very concerned about it because they don't really want to make robots. Google looks out at the parking lot and sees a lot of robots without software, while most of the car manufacturers, they wanted to have cyborg cars. You sit down as a driver, and now you become enhanced and drive. They don't want to make robots. My point here is that we might have thresholds where technology develops well enough to do surprising things. Google did the same thing with machine translation, a classic problem that people have been struggling with very little success for decades. By simply taking a lot of text, and the same text translated in different languages, put it together, and use that to make statistical guesses. No linguistics involved, just statistics. And this works pretty well. It's not as good as a human translator, and sometimes it does amusingly bizarre translations, but it's good enough for a lot of everyday users. So this kind of sudden jump to good enough can have enormous economic effects. So some of my colleagues in Oxford, Carl Frey and Michael Osborne, they did a little report based on what skills are involved in different jobs. Some skills seem to be very hard to automate. In artificial intelligence, it's called the Moravec paradox, that it's fairly easy to make a software system that plays chess or solves differential equations, but very hard to make one that can pick up a piece of paper or make a cup of tea. The things that are easy for us in everyday life turn out to be very hard for machines, while the stuff we spend a lot of time at university to learn generally turn out to be fairly easy. So based on this, they looked at the different skills and made some educated guesses about what would be hard to automate. And then they looked at various professions and what skills go into that. And they came up with this, by now, the famously repeated number that 47% of all jobs are kind of threatened by automation over the next few decades. One can quibble a fair bit about methodology, but people who have repeated it generally end up with something similar. A large number of jobs might actually be automatable because they involve routine tasks. Anything that is unique, that you need creativity, and human and strategic intelligence or social intelligence, that's hard. We don't know how to do it. Anything that is a relatively routine task that doesn't require hand-eye coordination or flexibility might be automatable. And in the past, we have mostly been thinking about, of course, automating physical tasks. But the same thing goes with mental tasks, too. An awful lot of paper pushing going on in our society is actually routine. It might involve some understanding text to some rudimentary degree, but it might be possible to automate. And that might, of course, change society quite a lot. It's one thing when various relatively unskilled occupations get transformed. Another thing when middle management gets threatened. They got a fair bit of political voice and might be rather loud if they get replaced. So in general, I think we're going to, in the future, see some of these surprises. And they're very hard to predict because a lot of them depend on whether somebody comes up with a clever algorithm that can do a particular thing. If somebody, for example, solved the problem of dexterous manipulation, suddenly a whole chunk of jobs would be in trouble. If somebody came up with a better way of understanding spoken language or written language, that might have other very big impacts. We're already seeing that in some legal professions where various legal aids suddenly find themselves replaced by search engines. IBM are kind of betting the farm that their Watson system is going to be able to do both help doctors make a diagnosis, but also, of course, help legal people to find good court cases that fit their argument. So that leads to this kind of interesting question, both what is uniquely human and might be impossible to replace. I've been mentioning strategic, creative, and social intelligence. I don't think that's impossible to do in a machine. I'm fairly confident eventually we're going to fix even that problem. At which point we're going to have much bigger issues than just work. Because once you can make something as smart as a human, now you can also start using the machines to make smarter machines, and things might take off from that. This is where we get over to the questions Elon Musk and Hawking are concerned about. But we also have these practical aspects that many jobs are actually symbolic. It might matter who is doing them. Sometimes joke that priests, prostitutes, and politicians have pretty safe jobs because they have a symbolic role to some extent in what they're doing. You don't want to have a robot priest because presumably you assume there is something important about it having a soul. Of course, I can totally imagine somebody coming up with religions claiming that machines have souls and it's not a problem. But in general, it looks like the symbolic jobs might be fairly safe. There are some other jobs where you might want legal responsibility. I'm concerned about the problem of making a safe and ethical machine. Making a law-abiding machine is a simpler problem, and it's still horrendously hard. After all, the letter of the law is not actually what you're supposed to follow. You're supposed to follow the meaning of the law, which is tremendously hard. So that might...
Yeah.
So this leads to this question, well, where does this automation lead to? Well, I think in general, this is kind of good news if you're a smart, adaptive person. If you're not very adaptive, then you might have a problem. If you want to actually have a secure system where you know where everything is and how what every role is, and of course the institutions based on this assumption that everything in its place, then I think the next few decades are going to be rather tough. So we need to kind of handle these changes, especially since we might be rather hard to predict. I think also we might want to look in particular at some jobs which we right now don't have any idea how to automate, but it would be tremendously disruptive if we could automate and actually keep a watch on how close are we to doing that. My own favorite example would be law enforcement, which is actually seriously scary if you could automate. We might want to empower law enforcement and make it better and so on to actually use the automation as a complement. But as we've been seeing in the discussions about the NSA and other spying scandals, that empowerment has not been combined with a proportional increase in oversight. We might also have a moral demand to automate certain jobs. My favorite example is medicine. When you can turn stuff into gadgets, the price comes down exponentially. If it's a service, the price tends to stay up. So in order to give medicine to a lot of people, we might seriously want to automate that, even though it might be a bad news for the doctors and nurses, it might actually be good news for humanity. So I think my conclusion is, yeah, we need to pay attention here and be prepared for surprises that some jobs that previously looked like they're unassailable could be changed completely. Sometimes not even by very smart software. The existence of YouTube videos of lectures have mean that if you're a bad lecturer, your students will instead be watching a better lecture from some other university. You don't need the artificial intelligence to totally change a profession, but it certainly helps. Thank you.
Very much. I'm having difficulty connecting to the internet to tweet, so I think I need a robot. But there we go. Some very helpful and useful reflections there from Anders to help set the scene. I'd now like to welcome our second speaker to the lectern this afternoon, Dr. Richard Ixell, a senior policy officer from the Trade Union Congress. We'd like to give him a warm welcome.
Thanks very much, Matt. My name is Richard Ixell. I'm a senior labour market economist at the TUC. And I'm very, very cautious about entering this debate because amongst economists, this is a notoriously difficult subject to make any sort of predictions about. And so all the time, whenever I sound particularly confident, remind yourself he's just guessing. It's not just because the past record of economists on this, and Keynes famously predicted we were about to go through a period of technological unemployment just a couple of years before we entered 25 years of remarkable employment growth and stability. So it's not just that, but also the nature of the technological change, where it's difficult to see too many years ahead what the change is going to be like, adds another level of complication to the picture. first point that I want to make is that sometimes it's assumed that the union posture in relation to automation and roboticisation is going to be entirely defensive, that we're going to be neo-Luddites. And the reality is rarely that simple. Unions, if you look at unions' record within individual companies, which is where most of our strength lies, unions tend to be a force for greater investment in technology, supporting, especially when it can be linked to upskilling of our members. So the assumption that unions will always be hostile is usually wrong. The point is, though, that we're always looking for the introduction of new technology on fair terms that takes account of the interests of all stakeholders. And it's the assumption that those interests can just be ridden roughshod over that we often object to. What I'm going to say is that, yes, there's real risks to employment from the technological change that's coming up, but also technological progress, this has the potential to deliver substantial job gains, so long as it's associated with active labour market interventions that can deliver the stronger and fairer economy we need. Now, some of the people who pointed to the risks include Andrew McAfee from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who's argued that technological progress is eliminating the need for many types of jobs. Tyler Cowen, who said that people whose jobs can just as easily be done by foreigners, robots, or a few thousand lines of code will suffer accordingly. But the past history of new technology, what's old technology nowadays, has been that it's not led to the jobs and slaughtering in quite the way that it's talked about by the people who are suggesting that, you know, the sky's going to fall in, everyone's going to lose their job. For instance, we've got jobs now in warehousing and distribution that are enabled by advances in information technology. A whole new creative industry sector in app design and gaming that didn't even exist a few years ago. So that new technology can create jobs as well as destroy them. But it doesn't mean the Luddites were totally wrong when they vandalised knitting machines. Because for them as individuals, the key aspect of that new technology was it did destroy their jobs. And back in the days before the welfare state, it meant they and their families were reduced to absolute paupery and miserisation. So what they needed, really, was a powerful trade union movement arguing on behalf of their interests. But equally, if you look at how things can go, well, if you look at some other countries, in particular some of the Scandinavian countries, they've succeeded in managing the labour market transitions, that not just technological change, but also the winds of globalisation have brought about in a much more positive way. I was very struck by the example of Denmark's textile industry. I wonder if this is the first time anyone at this podium in this room has ever talked about the lessons to be learned from Denmark's textile industry. But they had the same problem that our textile industry has had. They threats the competition, firstly from cheap products coming in from Asia, and then new technology was taking away their competitive advantage in design. But instead of just saying, well, we've got to put up with it, the devil take the hindmost, they had an approach that brought in the politicians. So in the towns with a textile industry, the local government was involved. The companies that that were affected worked on this, and so did the trade unions, to develop a plan that within 10 years had moved the Danish textile industry up the value chain. So instead of producing the sort of clothes that I wear, they were producing the sort of clothes that I'd like to be able to wear. And the people working in that industry were, as individuals, doing more fulfilling, more creative work than they had been doing before. The point was, everyone was able to work together for that because they were confident that no one was going to be left out in the process. And so that's part of the condition for making the most of of technological change. We need, as a country, first of all, a workforce that welcomes training. Now, one of the points about the unpredictability about technological change is we can't be sure that the skills that we invest in when we're in our teens and 20s are still going to be needed by the time we get to our 40s and 50s. If we live in a world in which there's no preparation for that, in which people who've invested their years at school and university in developing skills, who've foregone employment during that period, then simply pay the price of losing their jobs when technological change comes along, then eventually people are going to learn the lesson and say, well, I'm not going to get that new training that they're talking about. Or increasingly, I think in this country, young people are going to say that £30,000 invested in a university degree, if it's not necessarily going to give them skills that can last more than 10 years, are going to decide that it's not worth the investment. Equally, if the workforce are resistant to change because their interests haven't been taken into account, then the stable in business environment that the firms investing in robotics will need, because a lot of it is going to be very expensive to get the capital started off, are also going to hold back on their investment. So it's the importance of a partnership approach that I'd emphasise. Final point I'd like to make is, although we can all see the risks to jobs from robots, if we look at what's actually happened in recent years, we had a big burst of increased unemployment across the Western world 5 years ago. Robots had nothing to do with that. It was the global economic crisis brought on by problems in finance industry rather than technological change that brought that about. So if we're looking to what's the threat to employment at the moment, generally speaking, most economists focus their eyes on the traditional concerns about supply and demand more than on what technological change is going to do, for the good reason that so far that's been what's had more of an impact. Final thought, if the jobs do go, there's still opportunities for us to cope with that. For instance, a basic income, an unconditional democrat, taking the place of the benefits system, without conditionality, without a means test. Or a job guarantee, directing people to publicly paid for work that would not be paid for by the private sector. They're ways of coping with any shortfall in jobs. So even if my perhaps a bit blasé assumption that it's not necessarily going to be too much of a worry proved to be wrong, there are still ways that we can cope with it. The key point is the approach that takes everyone's interests into account, rather than assuming that we just let markets react. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. Particularly thanks for being able to bring the Danish tips up. It's been a debate on robots or what, but thank you, very interesting set of reflections there. We're now coming to our third and final short presentation. Professor Nigel Cameron, he's the President of the Centre for Policy and Emerging Technologies in Washington DC, and also very pleased that he serves as our Executive Chairman of the Applied Centre here in the UK. So let's give a warm welcome to Nigel.
Thank you very much. Well, it's very nice to be back here in the UK, and I hope you can't tell from my accent that I have lived now for nearly 24 years in the US. I think I tend to speak like a Brit but think like an American, as my friends on both sides say. It seems to me that the discussion we're having today has the most profound implications, and it's its implications which are motivating my entry into the conversation. I suppose there are really three options in one's initial approach to the question, and that is to say there are those people who say it's going to happen but don't worry, those who are saying it's going to happen but do worry, and those who are saying we're just not bothered. And those in category three dominate not least government. I think they also dominate the trade unions and certainly the US unions also. They dominate many sectors in the economy, voluntary sector, where one would have thought this conversation would be a much higher profile discussion than it has been. I've recently had several conversations in the US about this. We convened a similar discussion to this one at my think tank in Washington, and we had AFL-CIO, which is the US equivalent of the TUC, involved. We had a senior federal government economist and so on. And the basic view was, don't worry, don't worry. And it seems to me that the logical position that the reasonable observer, sort of risk-focused observer, will take in this situation is worry. So with that to begin, I was first alerted to this discussion by a man with the marvelous name Marshall Brain. Marshall Brain, it's his real name, was the founder of the very successful website How Stuff Works, which I'm sure many of you have used, which he sold many years ago. He's a computer scientist. And Marshall was speaking at one of the conferences organized by Rick Kurzweil, who some of you will know is the great enthusiast for all things for the future, and who believes we shall all be living on hard drives before we die, so on and so forth. Very much an enthusiast for all these things, thinks they're going to happen soon, and they're going to be good. Now, many in his own circle think they're going to happen soon, and it maybe is going to be problematic. And Marshall Brain was speaking at one of his conferences, and he put up on a screen the short version of the US Department of Labor job classifications, as a standard form people in the US use to indicate their job on tax forms and that kind of thing. And he put it up on a screen and went down it. And without the infinite detail which the James Martin study, which began with over 900 categories and went down to 700 categories and estimated them all by risk, but without the detail of this, he went down it and said, that's about half the jobs in the economy that are going to go. So with his intuitive approach and with his very detailed approach and an excellent report which I'd recommend you read, it looks like something like that over the course of the next 20-ish years. And this is the case, not least in this report, in terms of detailed analysis job by job. So there seem to be those three options. Now, my concern is that there is a reasonable chance that what is going on here is not the classic Industrial Revolution approach, going back to what happened with the Luddites, where people lose their jobs, terrible strife, out of that come new jobs with higher value, which is the classic example given people who say it's going to happen but don't worry. But instead what we're doing here is scouring the labour factor out of the value equation. We're basically now so smart that we're going to be able to remove the need for people, not simply in these particular jobs, But in any possible jobs, at least that could be done by these people. That is to say, I'm not arguing that novelists will all be machines, or that there'll be top management jobs all to be done by machines. One doesn't need to argue that. All one needs to argue is that vast sectors of the economy are having the labour factors scoured out of the value equation. Of course, the most striking example of this has been some of these amazing internet companies, WhatsApp, Instagram, with a handful of employees worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. And when you have $19 billion and you have a dozen or two employees, you realise that we are now in a position to create enormous amounts of value and create hardly any jobs in the process. That is the sort of concern one has. I mean, Instagram versus Kodak is very interesting. Kodak at one point had, I think, 165,000 jobs in the company itself, plus all the developing shops all over the world. Now, my question is, why is it that there is no major discussion of this question? You know, in the debates in Parliament, in debates for the next election, debates for the presidency in the US, why is it this is not the lead concern of trade unions? Why is it not a huge issue in the voluntary sector, preparing for this serious possibility? That, to me, is the most interesting question in this discussion. There is, of course, the Luddite charge. Who wants to be called a Luddite? Well, I certainly don't want to be. I'm actually very pro-technology. I think we should embrace these things. We can't stop them anyway. They're going to happen. Let's embrace them and put them to good use. But people do not like being called Luddites. And it's a very easy piece of mud to sling. And if you raise any serious question about technology and its implications, somebody will call you a Luddite. And I think that's a significant element in the dynamic of these conversations. The fact that people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates have been raising these questions and suggests a certain respectability for them. But I think they're going to have to come up with a term which is as powerful as Luddite for those of us who say, we need to worry about these things even as we embrace them, because that, I think, is the rational position in this discussion. Another reason, of course, why politicians don't like tackling these things is because they need to look ahead beyond the next election. Mercifully, in this country, elections are 4 or 5 years apart. In the US, the key elections are 2 years apart. And so we have this foreshortened view of the future, in which there's basically no value, no political value in raising problematic issues that stretch over that horizon. And thirdly, of course, there is the huge nature of the problem. Because this seems to be not some sort of technical difficulty that we're going to need to resolve. We're talking here about structural unemployment on a scale the world can hardly imagine. We're talking about losing half the jobs in the economy. And we're talking about, well, Marshall Brain was on this call, Marshall, his comment was, of course we're going to create all sorts of new jobs in the process, and they'll be done by more machines. And the kind of people who are lorry drivers and who are cashiers and so on and so forth, often quite smart people who have not had a good education, and therefore they end up doing complicated jobs, but jobs that don't require formal qualifications. Those very people are the ones whom it's going to be very hard to retrain to do any of the elevated jobs which will remain. It seems to me there's a logical process here, which may well be one, of scouring the labour factor out of large areas of the economy in a way that will not be possible to replace it. Now, so what are the answers? Well, Richard Excel raised the question of the basic income. I mean, Richard Nixon wanted a basic income. It isn't just a left-wing question. But I think we have to find some way to depoliticize this discussion about how we would cope with this situation. I think more fundamentally, it involves our rethinking notions of employment, unemployment, part-time employment, voluntary sector versus commercial sector. It involves rethinking on a part about leisure. I mean, there are two kinds of people in the world who, when they wake up in the morning, don't have to do any work. The very rich and the very poor. They're in exactly the same position. Why is it for some heaven and for others hell? Seems to me we could be creating a situation of heaven or a situation of hell, depending how we frame these questions, and how we frame them will determine how we end up resolving them in terms of politics and economics. So that seems to me to be the fundamental question. Why is it governments and leaders in other sectors of the economy will not recognise that? Let us say that there is a 20% chance, a 3% chance, a 40% chance. Who knows what that chance is? But it is measurable and it's real. This is not simply some extraordinary outlying possibility. If there is that sort of chance of this sort of disruption, then one would have thought this should be high on their agenda and it should be a major concern on their part. On this teleconference, which we had in the US, we had there was someone from AFL-CIO, And I was chairing the conversation, so I could ask hard questions. And I simply said to him, well, you know, there are, I think, 5.3 million lorry driving jobs in the US, truck driving jobs. That's one statistic which is good news. And if the Google stuff works, they may well begin with trucks, because the cost base is so much higher, and the risk is so much higher. And people are terrible drivers, and the machines are not terrible drivers. And I think also about insurance and so on is just pooey. I mean, there's going to be no problem with finding legal ways to enable these things to be done. I said, that would be 5.3 million jobs. I said, what about the Teamsters? And the Teamsters is the very powerful American union for truck drivers. I said, they will have zero members. I mean, zero. Doesn't this concern anybody? They're AFL-CIO. And, well, the answer I got was a sort of, you know, mellifluous, responsible answer. And he did raise questions about the training and upskilling and so on and so forth. It seems to me, though, that the dramatic nature of these problems is such that they are of more significance than that. Partly because, of course, we're talking about exponential change, an exponential pace of change, versus the kind of gradual pace of change which we're much more used to, in which it's possible to rearrange the pieces, to rearrange the furniture. So that's my concern. Why is it these people are not much more concerned about these things, and how can we get their attention?
If I can ask each or three of our speakers to join me at the front, now we have some seats for them to sit on. Our panel, just to give you the opportunity to perhaps digest some of what's been said and get ready to form your questions. Can I come to our panel first and see, give you the opportunity if there's anything that's been said by the other two respondents this afternoon that you want to respond to. Perhaps Anders, you were the first to start, but anything the other two have said that you'd like to come back on or reflect on?
I really like your point here about the labour equation, because that's actually what has worried me the most. At our institute, we generally tend to spend most of our effort trying to think about the far future, the really strange future. But what really worries me, if you just look at the economic equations, what if you can turn capital into labour? It's not just that a lot of people might be unemployed. You also actually get a concentration of power, because if I'm very rich, now I can buy all the necessary brain power I want, or at least the labor power, and that seems to create a feedback loop. But you don't necessarily have to be Piketty to be worried about that.
I was waiting for Mr. Piketty's name to be mentioned,
yeah,
and finally it has.
Yeah, so now it's done. Well, we don't need to mention that anymore.
Richard,
would you
like to respond to?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I've just shown the disadvantages of going off-piste, thinking, oh, I've thought of something interesting to say, and forgetting half the text that you've written down beforehand. But one of the reasons why, in the trade union movement, we're a bit cautious about saying that the risks are to jobs are that high is because we went through this 30 years ago when trade unions did, in this country, did very seriously think that we were coming up to an era of compulsory leisure, when, you know, the difficulty that workers would face would be what to do with all the leisure time we had. And we even published a number of books about how to deal with that problem. And of course, it never happened, which is why I think that the key issue to deciding about how to make use of the extra wealth that's created by technological change is political rather than technological. And one of the things that worries. Sorry if I was one of the things that worries me is the possibility that if the jobs go, and we do deal with it by, say, for instance, a basic income, that only deals with one set of human needs. I think that the need for status is every bit as important as the need for income. And I'm really worried about a future in which we forget about all the human jobs that need doing. Now, one part of the opportunity that's inherent in the changes is it frees up labour and provides the money that we could use to invest in a whole series of caring roles that are desperately needed at the moment. So instead of the people working in nurseries and in social care being badly treated and disrespected, if we could find the way of using the money to pay for those services and giving them higher status and more respect. Now that's the sort of hope that I've got for technology. And I'd rather focus on what we're hoping for than what we're worrying about.
Helpful set of reflections there. Okay, I open up the floor. Anyone would like to pose a question? Start off this. Would you like to perhaps direct your question to a particular individual?
Well, no, not really. It was really about any of you. I mean, one of my concerns is the issue that in Africa there is huge population increase that's likely to happen of people of working age. And the big push is to try and get more jobs there. And here we are, talking about perhaps half the sort of, rather basic lower end of jobs disappearing. And I guess not just, we're talking about the global economy here, not just developed countries. So what's the future for the poor, as you were saying in your presentation? You get up in the morning with nothing to do. What are we going to do with these ever-increasing numbers of people who are left in that position and who don't really have the prospect of a kind of decent income appearing from nowhere? Any thoughts on that?
Well, just offer a brief. I mean, it seems to me the problem here is the pace of change. If we had 50 years to get ourselves in the mood for this, and we had some leaders who would think 50 years ahead, we might manage essentially to sort of re-sculpt our notions of leisure and poverty and voluntary versus, paid employment and so on and so forth, in such a way that would depoliticize these. It wouldn't be a sort of, we need a socialist solution rather than the market, which I think is, if you are politicizing it that way, we're not going to resolve these at all, ultimately. We have to find a fresh way to sculpt the discussion. Now, my concern is, how do we do this fast? The last discussion I had about this was with a group of economists at the World Bank, and we were looking precisely at that. What are going to be the knock-on effects in developing economies of the very rapid progress? But so many things are going well now in developing economies. Very exciting situations in Africa and other parts of Asia going ahead. But what will be the impact on this of these very rapid developments here in the West? And it seems to me as a global problem, we might expect our global leaders to be wanting to address it. But ultimately, we don't have to refashion our notions of what it means to be employed and unemployed, and go back in a sense, before the Industrial Revolution. A sort of pre-industrial, post-industrial society, in which there simply is not the production labour process at the heart of our lives.
Richard, refashioning our notion of what it means to be in work and be employed. Any thoughts on that?
Marx famously looked forward to a world in which we teach in the morning, hunt in the afternoon, and politicise in the evenings. And
we're heading towards the evening now, so
one of the goals that workers have always had is for a life that allows them, well, first of all, to get the necessities of existence, but once that's been satisfied, something that allows enough time for leisure, and then something that's got meaning to it. And part of one of the hopes for technological change would be that if we could roboticize the meaningless jobs, the jobs that only confer status insofar as they're giving you a pay packet. If we could roboticize that, those jobs, and use the surplus to pay for work that everyone would value. And because, if you talk to someone whose mum has been looked after by a good care worker, that care worker is one of the most important people in their world. And that care worker's job certainly isn't going, going to be automated.
The Japanese, I mean, we have a lot of push on this. Very specifically, because they have an aging population.
I should have said not in this country. I'm aware that the Japanese want to keep out the immigrants because they'd rather be served by robots than by careers. But certainly you can make a case within Britain for care work being done by people.
I think that would be wonderful, but I just think it's a fantasy. Seems to be the logic of this. I mean, part of the problem, precisely as you say, is that jobs like caring jobs, driving jobs, customer service jobs in general, these are the very jobs which are going to go, and they're the jobs that provide really interesting, meaningful work for people who are not very well qualified. This is a central social problem, it seems to me.
I think the interesting question is the qualification part. So normally when we talk about a well-qualified job, that means that you need to be a symbol manipulator. You need to have gone to university and be very good at juggling various more or less arbitrary symbols in ways that fit in with your job. While people who have a more concrete mode of thinking, they don't generally find it tough to get through university, and they get these jobs, which might actually, in many ways, be easier to automate. Not all of them. Some of them are probably tougher to automate than many of the very symbolic ones. I'm a bit worried about my friends in the underwriting business, because half of underwriting seems to be something I think I could replace with a fairly short script. The other part is super hard to automate, but half of it might be, although it's high status and well paid, might be a problem. So the problem would be, can you actually take people who are now in a concrete mode of thinking and educate them to do these upskilled jobs, the jobs where you're actually getting a legion of machines to do something. And that suggests to me that we actually might need to invent new forms of education or job education, how to actually do these jobs. Instead of phrasing it as a read this big pile of textbooks and write an exam about it, you actually need to develop these kind of procedural skills. That's very different. I don't know if anybody knows how to do it. It seems to be a good research project, and I have no clue who would actually want to pay for it, but it would be worthwhile to investigate. And this, of course, goes also for people in other countries. In different economies, people have different modes of concreteness and abstraction, as well as the structure. Automation is not going to affect all economies in the same way. In some places, it might be even scarier than having the oil curves. If the government doesn't actually need the people because it got a good income from oil, it's likely to treat the people bad, except maybe in Norway. On the other hand, you might get the same thing if you could do the resource extraction robots. Now you don't actually need any citizens. We're just a danger. That's a seriously scary possibility. So we might want to figure out actually also a bit of a different scenario to see what can we do to make sure some of the nasty ones don't come to pass. And here I think globalization can actually be rather useful, because it's not just for automation that is globalizing, we can transfer the software, we can also transfer solutions between countries.
Can I take a couple of questions, I think, and then we can, when the panel take one and the other. So, just right at the back, and I'll come to you, sir, Lou.
So, I just wondered whether you thought robots have rights, and if they have rights, do they have responsibilities?
So whether robots will then have rights, and if that's the case, do they have responsibilities as well? That's the first question. And so the blue?
Yes, I just don't think we have that today, which was that we tend to approach the encouragement of jobs in a kind of onward march up a hierarchy. Is it likely that the jobs that are first going to go are going to be the high value, highest value jobs, because that's where you're going to get the biggest return on your capital investment? Is there any margin for thinking that in fact the creeping upwards, as we imagine it, is not going to be a creeping upwards, but in fact it's going to be a specifically targeted top-down approach.
Okay. So robots will have rights and responsibilities, and then we're talking about the creeping up, right? Is it actually going to target in at a particular level as opposed to a creeping up? Anders, do you want to take the robots and rights initially?
Well, since I pretend to be a philosopher or something like that, generally, robots, in order to have a right, you need to understand it. You need to understand that you want to have a right, at least to some extent. And it's going to be a long while before we actually get to the point where robots understand not just the world well enough, but themselves and the relationship to the world, where it would make sense to talk about robot rights. At that point, of course, we're going to have a lot of very interesting problems. At that point, yes, the robots would have responsibility. Before that, you might get into concerns. Maybe there might be moral patience. If I kick my car today, I'm just being silly. But an autonomous car might actually detect it's getting damaged. It still probably doesn't matter, because it actually doesn't care about being damaged. There is probably going to be something in its internal software that makes it move away from it. But we might even interpret it as it being afraid of being hurt. But actually, there is no real pain. There is nothing going on. Eventually, we might reach at that point. I've written a little bit about when that might happen. But we're rather far away from that. So right now, it's not a problem. Once the robots actually start to understand us well enough to have a theory of mind and understand each other, yeah, at that point we might actually worry about giving them rights. But that's going to be rather far away. And in some cases we might not want to deliberately decide them not to get that. We actually just want them to be tools.
Nigel, far away or completely unimaginable that we're not going to have be in a place where we're going to need robots' rights?
Well, interesting. In fact, interestingly, the member of Congress in the US, Brad Sherman, Democrat member whom I know, some years ago tried to get funding out of the Congress for non-ambitious AI, specifically seeking to culture the kind of use of AI which would not lead to this kind of problem. So you would have sort of humble AIs that were not going to claim rights themselves, and the committee laughed him out of court and he didn't get the money. It seems to me that we're driven by our imagination, the whole area of rights. And the 21st century imagination is much, much more given to rights talk than, for example, in the 17th century, where you had a lot of talk of rights, but still, the race issues and so on and so forth were still very prominent. But we now have a very expansive notion of human rights. We want to extend rights in various ways to the higher mammals and so on and so forth, corvids maybe, and dogs, and octopuses and so on. And I mean, we've begun to move beyond our notion really of human rights. Seems to me, if we are confronted with entities which engage us in serious conversation and whom we in various ways trust, this will certainly be the case with caring machines. And certainly, if they have a human aspect to them, the Japanese love putting these faces on their robots. I think it's going to happen. I mean, we will, because we think emotionally, intuitively. Of course, you all saw Bicentennial Man, Robin Williams' film from 25 years ago. Where he's the robot who ends up looking more and more like a human and behaving like a human and falling in love like a human and so on and so forth. And I think this is not implausible.
Richard, to move on about where jobs would be, inference being kind of going to be a creeping in and emerging growth, are they going to actually kind of come in and target particular levels of employment? Your thoughts on that, perhaps?
Well, certainly you'd expect that to the extent that robotics is an expensive investment, it would first of all appear to replace those jobs that are expensive for employers to pay for. So when it's possible to replace expensive work by a robot, then that's where the investment would go first. I mean, the trajectory of technology usually, though, is that prices start coming down quite quickly. And so although you might start with the more expensive workers, the most highly paid, being subject to competition from robots, that would change fairly quickly. Another moderating factor would be who's making the decision, and very often the decisions will be made by people who are either those highly paid workers or people who've risen from the ranks of those highly paid workers, and they may well have more fellow feeling with people in those jobs than with people in lower status jobs.
I just sort of say that nevertheless we have supermarket cashiers now, being replaced by very clunky machines.
Yeah.
Because the machines are not particularly expensive for that purpose.
Mm.
and therefore, you know, there's an economic argument for it.
Yeah.
I think they're going to sit for both ends.
A lot of it also depends on how you can redefine the job. You can replace the cashier with a clunky machine because you can get customers to do the job. Making a robot that can wash dishes is really hard, but making a dishwasher is actually very easy because you get humans to put in stuff in the right ordering. So a lot of it might be about how you can redefine the job. Professor Paul Newman at Oxford, who made the Oxford autonomous car, he told me, slightly boasting, but I think it's right, that if I could just specify a task crisply, he and his engineers could do it. And I think he's right. If we actually know how to do a particular job or a particular task well enough and can tell an engineer, they can come up with something. Most jobs, however, are rather ill-defined, and most of them have actually quite a lot of components which are not even in the proper job description. The fact that underwriters need to be social enough to talk to brokers and understand weird arcane rules of the Lloyd's market, there's only a few lines about that, but a lot of things about statistics. But the statistics part might actually not be what we're getting paid for.
Okay, can I have one more question for the floor? I think it comes to you, sir, and the gentleman in the middle there.
Okay, so as somebody who's spent a bit of time celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Luddites uprisings, I feel that I do have to give you the very, very short lecture about the Luddites, because the word has tended to be used in this meeting, not in the totally crudest sense of a person who is against technology, but there has been that general flavour to the way it's been used, and that's completely wrong. Luddites were in no way against machinery in general. Their motto was that they would put down machines hurtful to commonality, which has a bunch of meanings which I won't go into, but in general it means the common good. So they were against technology that was against the common good rather than in general, and that was reflected in their practice. You know, when they smashed the machines, they left the other machines alone. They targeted the ones that were taking their jobs. So that's the end of the thing on the Luddites. And I think we should all actually be proud to call ourselves Luddites in that sense. Second thing I just wanted to mention is that I'm later this year organising a meeting on much of these kind of issues that Richard has been talking about. If anybody's interested, I'd love to talk to you about that afterwards. Third comment was this thing about the macroeconomic effects of technology is already really seriously with us. I'll just quote that flaming radical Al Gore, who said in his, who pointed out in his book that this effect of polarization of wealth that we've seen in neoliberal economies over the last 30 years is substantially, not completely of course, but very significantly about automation, which tends to polarize wealth to the owners of technology. And he says, and I think he's right, that that's already a significant factor, for example, in the sluggish response recovery from the financial crash. There isn't a demand in the economy. People don't have the belief that they're going to have jobs in the future that they can spend, but actually it's already affecting people's purchasing power. So that's just, this is something that I'm ready. The main question I wanted to ask to Richard was, I've been involved in a range of issues around new technologies over the years, and the normal response of environmentalists and trade unionists and all kinds of people when you've got a new technology like this is regulate. That's those who don't want to abolish it entirely. The sort of middle of the road thing is regulate. So I'd be interested to know your thoughts about ways in which maybe one could regulate this technology in which it seems to me that what you might need is a national policy around along the lines that you described of what happened in Denmark. I mean, one has to say it's hard to imagine that happening in the British culture. The polarisation of class politics that there is in this society and the way that we adhere to the American free market model of social social development. So, but I'd be interested to hear what you think about the possibilities for, yeah, a national policy, a national dialogue on this that, you know, yeah.
Okay, so regulations, we'll come to that. Just one in the middle there.
This is sort of leading up to a question about the enhancement of the existing human workforce. Interestingly, you mentioned Professor Kevin Warwick, who was my personal tutor at uni, and he talked a lot about the idea of when a power struggle comes between, eventually, between humanity and some form of AI. The only way to keep pace is through enhancing what we already have. I also saw Anders do an interesting talk a couple of weeks ago here about enhancement. Could the possibility of both physical and cognitive enhancement work through pharmaceuticals or devices possibly prolong the employment of a large amount of the workforce by allowing them to keep pace in the short term, at least, short to medium term, of against sort of automation, robotization, and so on? Could that possibly extend it to a much further away problem of complete replacement to the point where we are dealing with human level AI? Because physically and cognitively we can keep pace for other means, it might possibly defer the point at which we need to worry about the complete replacement.
Okay. Now, if we come to you, Richard, on the regulatory approaches, and perhaps on to Nigel to give us some US contrast, and Anders, if we come on to you on the enhancement issue. So, yes, Richard.
I've got to say that I am arguing for an approach to managing change that doesn't have particularly good prospects in this country, it's got to be said. So, Britain, it has not up till now looked kindly on social partnership as an approach to dealing with our pressing economic problems. And I was talking about earlier on about the lessons that we learned from the 80s when we were expecting a growth of leisure. But that's partly because of the political choices that were made at the time. We had a huge, the information technology did actually happen. You know, this isn't the jetpack story. You know, every comedian's got a patter about, oh, where's my jetpack? The information technology revolution did actually happen, and it produced significant gains in wealth. But they weren't evenly divided, and so what? And so the impact of that was not to free us up for extra leisure or to enable the mass of people to achieve higher living standards, but to promote inequality and a vast improvement in the living standards of a tiny minority. Now, I think that the risk is of that. The chances that that will happen again are, at the moment, far greater than the chances of a more egalitarian solution. Though it's got to be said that, at the moment, even some of the most powerful voices worrying about inequality are the very rich indeed. You wouldn't have imagined this 20 years ago. You know, the main conversation at Davos this year was about inequality. Because, there's the obvious possibility of social and political instability. And I was saying that you know, scientific investment needs a stable environment. If the political impact of the changes, because of mismanagement of of this process of change, is actually to increase instability, then it makes the underpinnings of that of that technological revolution weaker. But also, there's the fact that in an economy, the one person's consumption is another person's demand, and if there are more and more people being driven into misery and absolute poverty, they're not going to be able to buy the stuff that the very rich people want to sell them. And there's a famous story from America, Walter Reuter, who was famous leader of the American Auto Workers Union, the boss of one of the car companies took him round a new plant, and saw these machines were trumpet, and they're all making the cars with hardly any people there. And he says, "Look at that, Walter, you try getting them to join your union." He says, "Yes, you try getting them to buy your cars. If we don't solve this, there's a real risk of the process eating itself up. So it starts with immiserization and greater poverty, but then there is the real risk that feeds out to everyone else as well."
No,
I buy that argument. It is, however, the case, that the average U.S. middle-class family is now less well-off than it was in 1983.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just gone down. Yeah. And this is partly I don't buy the whole Piketty argument, but I mean that there's substantial sections of his argument, which I think are undeniable. And it's interesting to me that we have his work, we have Mariano Mazzucato's work on the entrepreneurial state. Mm-hmm. We have a number of economists now thinking broadly, not specifically about this question, but about ways which actually intersect with it, very helpfully. My sense is that we're going to have to find a way out of the socialist versus market I'm trying to think of an appropriate term to use for this, which is entirely neutral, but dynamic, shall we say, in which we find other ways of capturing, if you like, social value, which are not regarded as anti-market or specifically concerned with producing equity. Because I think there are arguments for something other than equity here. There are arguments against social unrest. There are arguments for demand and so on and so forth, which need, I think, to have a major role in constructing the conversation that we're going to have to begin to have.
Anders, would you like to pick up on the second question?
So it seems like enhancement can solve problems, but not all. I'm happy to argue in favor of enhancement, but a lot of that, I think, is from a kind of existential human perspective that we might want to enhance ourselves. Would we actually want to enhance ourselves in order to keep our jobs? That seems to be a rather lousy reason to enhance yourself. However, it might work in some situations. In particular, it seems to be helpful if we need to be more flexible and actually be able to upgrade our job understanding. If a machine might be able to do my job, maybe I should be now doing the job of managing the machines that did my previous job and using my understanding for that that previous job to now do something better. In that case, I need to be flexible. I need to adapt to this change, and I might need to think a different way. In that case, cognitive enhancement might be a good idea. But it doesn't seem like any amount of cognitive enhancement is going to make the cab driver to keep his job if you have autonomous cars that are cheaper, faster, and safer. Warwick's idea about kind of cyborging ourselves so we can keep up with machines, I think it doesn't really work that well to try to keep up with the machines. Rather, one should actually go full tilt and say, no, we want to be the machines that are successful. Rather, we want the humble machines to do the boring stuff, and then we want to link to the machines so they actually understand our values. This is typically what we're concerned about at our institute. How do we get human values over to machines? How do we actually get the software to understand what we really want? Especially when we don't quite understand ourselves what we really want and are really bad at explaining it. And quite often we might even be wrong about ethics. If we could actually link ourselves up to the machines, we would partially solve that. It still would be an awfully hard problem. So I think in the long run, we might want to do that just in order to get as much human value over to our technology infrastructure to solve problems that we need or desire or must solve. But in the intermediate term, I think cognitive enhancement might be useful to handle a more fluid society, because many of us don't adapt that well, and we might want to handle that. We want lifelong learning to actually work better, and for that, some forms of cognitive enhancement might be useful. But it doesn't actually solve the problem. And also, getting approval for a cognitive enhancer drug as a cognitive enhancer drug, that's probably going to take way longer than it takes to introduce the robots and the autonomous cars and software. So it might very well be that the tool that would have helped, it's going to be approved in 20 years' time, by which point, of course, the automation has already happened.
Before I invite us, Claire's panelists, to sort of kind of a closing takeaway message for us, is there just one remaining last question from the floor, fairly short, succinct would be ideal. Yes, sir.
Sorry, just a very short one. I mean, just to develop the point about regulation, since no one quite touched it that much, I just wonder if I could put it more broadly. I mean, if we can mechanise or automate or roboticise, does it follow we notably should be doing it?
Well, just, it's part of the problem with our lack of having this as a significant public conversation is there isn't really a sort of matrix, as it were, within which to frame those questions, which will have any sort of valence in the public arena. I mean, it's in literature that these things, of course, been explored. Some of you may know a very fine book, He, She, and It, by Marge Pearson, which is about a society in which the one rule was that you may not make robots that look like humans, and of course somebody broke it. But it seems to me that there are things of that kind that we might well decide, but we have to have a much higher level of social engagement with these questions in order to be able to get that far.
And it's really upset that I know you kind of caught the first one.
Yeah, so I think there are a few specific regulations we might want. We might, for example, want to ban robots that actually harm people. That seems to be a very, very good idea to have an early ban and just avoid developing that. But generally, it's hard to prevent people from developing.
Try telling that to the Department of Defense in the US.
Yeah. Fortunately, there are some allies within the military because they don't really want to be robot herders. They actually want to be warriors, and it feels rather sad if they're going to be sitting in front of a computer. So there are some interesting battles about that. But the really fun question is, can you actually regulate the growth of technology? And generally, that doesn't work very well. But you can promote things that are useful so they come earlier than the more dangerous technologies. I think that is what we should be aiming for. We might actually try to look at what stuff would we really, really want to automate and try to push so we get that early in the home. That might be helpful for handling the bad consequences that might show up later, or we might actually learn things from the early automation in some domains and to handle it well. So it might not be so much banning certain kinds of robots, because that's always going to be hard, but that's really investing in, let's make sure we get a lot of autodocs or something like that.
Okay, thank you very much. The epic science fiction author Arthur C. Clarke famously said, politicians should read science fiction, not westerns and detective stories. This year is general election year, and so I might be forgiven today that I don't think many of these issues will probably figure in manifestos, I might be wrong. But just in closing this evening, with that in mind, and also just in terms of our discussion this afternoon, in terms of a takeaway message, I'm just going to give each of our panellists a minute or so to kind of just offer their kind of takeaway thoughts, and perhaps imagine the scenario, David Cameron or any of the leaders of the main political parties were here, what message would you like them to go away with and seriously to consider in terms of thinking about this particular issue into the future? As I give my panellists a little bit of a moment to think about that, I just want to turn to you and thank you very much for making the effort to be here this afternoon. As I said at the beginning, I hope it's contributed to conversation, if not as the conversation. Certainly this is this marks the start of a series of events and projects that BioCentre will be involved in over the course of the year, possibly in the next 2 years, in terms of how the growth of AI is affecting the future of humanity and the various themes which need to be addressed as part of that. As RSVPs to this event, you'll be added to our mailing list. I will be emailing you with details about how the MP3s can be accessed. Also giving the opportunity, therefore, for if you don't want to remain on our mailing list, to come off it. But please do. I encourage you to stay connected with us. As we say, we want to engage in the conversation and get as many different perspectives involved in the discussion. So thank you very much for your time. I will now turn back to our panellists. A takeaway message for us, but also a nod to the main political parties. What should we be really thinking about in terms of this issue? We'll start with Nigel.
Well, this is at least as big as climate change.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think we need to figure out more flexible solutions. The guaranteed basic income has been mentioned a number of times. And I think maybe that's a good idea. I don't know enough economics or politics to say that. However, people might be stopping at the solution they have heard about. And that might be the problem. Maybe we need to come up with even more solutions and more to choose between. And then we can decide.
I think the key lesson for the key message I'd want to send to the political parties is that a sustainable solution to a sustainable approach to developing new technologies has got to take into account the interests of the whole of society, not just one portion of it. And that if we want the sort of stability and security which are necessary for investment and for prosperity, then the whole of society has to be involved in the debate. And perhaps that's one of the good things that's happening at the moment. The collapse of our political culture might, fingers crossed, where's some wood to touch, open up the space for a politics that broadens the conversation.
Thank you very much. Would you like to join me in thanking our panelists? This leads me to bid you a very good evening. There is something taking place here at 6 o'clock, so if we'd like to continue your conversation as you file out, that would be appreciated. Thank you.